Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information and issues. The name of this show is Life in Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, let's look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. And this is from a post by Adam Levitin. It's called Why Credit Card Issuers Engage in Rate Jacking. Recently, the media has been abuzz with articles about rate jacking. Rate jacking is the often arbitrary increases in credit card holders' interest rates. At first glance, rate jacking makes little sense. Why raise rates on a good paying customer? The cardholder might decide to close the account, or the customer might not be able to service the higher rate debt and default. So why mess with a paying customer these days? In order to understand rate jacking, you have to understand two factors about credit cards. One is called lock-in, and two is the incentive to increase account volatility created by credit card securitization. So first, let's look at lock-in. Most customers, we discover, do not close accounts and switch cards because of higher interest rates. They do not perceive the switching costs as worthwhile. There's a transactional hassle, there's lots of accrued reward points that they would lose, and a perceived ding to their credit score. So what we see is a psychological input here in dealing with the increased credit interest rate. Furthermore, with that psychology, there is a minimalizing and discounting that takes place in the debtor's mind, coupled with a sense of optimism. Many people don't bother to switch cards because of a higher rate, because they don't think that they're likely to pay interest on the cards. In other words, they'll just pay off the card. So whatever the reasons, personal and psychological, generally consumers don't switch cards for less than $150 of increased costs. So what we see here is what is called a lock-in effect, and it's a very strong lock-in effect. People just simply don't change, which means, of course, that the credit card companies have an incentive to increase the interest rates. And the second thing is that securitization of the debt encourages rate jacking or increased interest rates. And it is known that credit card securitization is actually the key to rate jacking. Credit card securitization is different from mortgage securitization in three important ways. First, unlike mortgage securitization, where the mortgages are sold completely, downline to an investor, credit card issuers have some continued interest in the game. A typical credit card securitization requires the issuer to maintain a 7% untranched interest in the securitization trust. In actuality, most issuers keep an even larger interest in the trust, between 10 and 20%. Thus, for example, if we use 10% of the trust securities owned by the credit card company, that 10% is pari passu, which means it is treated as equal to and paid equally with the other 90% that are represented by outside investor certificates, which are usually tranched amongst themselves. This equality factor gives the credit card companies a huge hidden benefit. So what we see is that there is a relationship between the credit card company and the securitized portfolio. There can be gains and there can be losses, which is much different than with the sale of the mortgages. In the larger picture, that's a good thing, theoretically, for the debtor, until you look at all of the details of what goes on here. This leads us to the second issue, which is part of the net impact of the securitization of credit card debt. Credit card issuers retain what is called the excess spread, which is the revenue in surplus of what is needed to pay the asset-backed securities, sometimes called ABS. This sometimes does happen in the case with mortgages, but credit card excess spread is likely to be a larger percentage of the revenue. That's because the revenue from credit card receivables is harder to predict than from mortgages, because it is much more dependent upon contingent fees. So in the setup, the asset-backed securities are likely to be a smaller percentage of total revenue, lest there be a shortfall, which would hurt the credit issuer. And then the third point is that the credit card issuers only securitize the receivables, that is the income. They do not securitize the accounts. As we know, a mortgage securitization involves the sale of the entire loan. For cards, however, the issuer retains the account and hence controls the terms of the account, and with the unilateral ability by credit card issuers to change the contract, this is very powerful. So when we look at these three factors together, they explain why rate jacking makes a lot of sense to credit card issuers. The card issuer holds only a limited piece of the downside. So, for example, let's say there are $100 in asset-backed securities, and the issuer has a 10% stake in the trust. If there is a revenue shortfall of 10 for the securitization trust, the issuer loses only 1. Whereas, if there is a revenue surplus of 10, the issuer receives 20. What we're seeing is that credit card securitizations give issuers imbalanced upside benefits and downside risks. This setup is as if the issuer has both a call and a put option on the receivables. For those of you who understand trading, the issuer can buy the receivables at 100, even if they're worth 110, but can sell them at 99, even if they're worth 90. In this situation, it's the basic option price theory, which says that increased volatility increases the value of the options. Now, as I said, because credit card issuers control the terms of the account, they can really exploit this upside-downside imbalance. If the issuers jack up the rates, it will mean greater volatility for the receivables. The result is that there will be more cardholders who default, but the ones who don't will pay more. With the 10% hypothetical example pari passu stake, the issuer could incur a 10% increase in defaults for every 1% increase in revenue and still be neutral. And of course, the issuers have tremendous volumes of consumer data on which to base volatility predictions. So we see an imbalanced deal, which is why they jack up the rate, and it's happening more and more. But also recognize that not all credit card issuers engage in securitization. It's generally only the largest ones. Also, not all card receivables are securitized, even for the issuers that do engage in securitization, although that's growing. And in many cases, there's sometimes a first loss position for the issuer as well, which reduces the rate jacking incentive. And finally, too much rate jacking will also result in accounts closing as well as defaults. But in all, this starts to explain the rate jacking phenomenon. And it also might be that the market understands many of these points and discounts the purchase price of the asset-backed securities so that rate jacking is value neutral to the issuer or even value negative if it doesn't rate jack enough. But that doesn't mean that it's value neutral to the consumer, of course. And the curious thing is that none of the proposed legislation gets at this problem. It's just a matter of retroactive rate increases. It's a matter of lock-in and rate increases in general, and also of the application of back-end fees. So we see that the regulatory initiatives are picking up steam, but they may be missing the forest for the trees. When we look deeply, the credit card industry's problems aren't a few ugly billing practices as much as more deeply seated price structure problems that discourage transparent pricing. Again, that was from Adam Leventon, Why Credit Card Issuers Engage in Rate Jacking. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now let's continue with the second part of the show, where we're going to go over some basic issues that are helpful and useful for you and your life. Before I get going, I always start with an important credit, because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in these programs are directly from or based on the work theories and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tiagi, two of America's leading champions for debtors. And I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap. And I also suggest that you look at the archives of this show, Life and Debt, at www.kruufm.com to get a complete story on all of the very most basic important issues on dealing with your debt. What I've been discussing over the last couple of weeks is really the biggest purchase of your life, purchasing a home that is not only there as your basic financial expense, but that is really right for you and enjoyable for you. The point that I want to recap from last week was rule number 5, and that was I suggested that you buy a home that really makes you happy, that makes you smile. This is really the most important rule. You have gotten to the place through all of the other discussions that I have made, the rules and the issues that would come up in getting your house, picking it out, getting a mortgage that is the best possible mortgage for you. But before you sign on the dotted line of the home purchase and the mortgage, you have to stop and ask yourself really an important question. Does this home make you happy? In essence, does it fit into your life and does it make you smile? Each morning when you wake up, is this the place you really want to be? And when you come home from work or from school and you open the front door, is that the place that you feel comfortable in? Now, if you're buying a house that someone else owned, which many of us do, not a brand new house, the other person could have loved many of the things in that house, and it may be things that you love too. But we have to recognize that, in fact, not everyone likes the same things in a house, and there just isn't anything in the world that's worth feeling lousy about where you live that is justifiable. You have to remember that a home isn't just an investment for your money. A home is truly an expression of who you are, whether that is something that's cozy, like a cozy cottage, or something that's formal Victorian type home, or something that meets your personal likes and characteristics that make you tick and make you happy. Your house is a place that has to be an expression of who you are, perhaps a place to start a marriage, a place to raise your children, or a place to grow old in. And as I mentioned last week, A good house is like a good shoe. It should fit you, and it can't be too small. Just like a shoe, your foot would be damaged if you put it into a shoe that was too small. Same thing with the house. It can't be too small if that doesn't fit you. And on the other hand, it can't be too big. Just like a shoe could not be too big. It would create a discomfort and some problems if you were to wear it. Your home is something that will affect you every single day of your life as an owner there. So you have to use your head and your heart. When it comes time to choose, buy a place where your personal characteristics are expressed, because it is the place where you live and you want to make the most out of living. So in a way, it's an expression that is of yourself and needs to fit who you are in as many ways as is possible. So once again, the final point, the final rule is that your home is a place that should make you happy. It is a place that should make you smile. So as a final recap, the rules for really smart home buying. Rule number one was pay off your debt, your steal from tomorrow debt before you buy a home. Rule number two was save until you have at least 10% for down payment, but actually better yet to have 20% for down payment. Rule number three was buy a home that you can afford. Rule number four was get the cheapest mortgage. And then, as we reviewed again today, rule number five was buy a home that makes you happy, a home that makes you smile. And as I said, you can go into prior shows in the archives at Crew FM, Life in Debt, and listen to all of these rules in an expanded form over the last 3 or 4 weeks. And now, once we were armed with all of those rules and facts, and we've gotten our budget together by following the setup I've been discussing regarding your net income every month, and you're finally in the position where you're ready to go out there and buy the home of your dreams, or it came out that you had to wait a couple of years until you're ready. But when you reach that point where you are ready and you're motivated and your mind is made up, and that's all from your side, you have to start dealing with what's going to come from the environment, the reciprocal points, which we like to call the buts, coming from the real estate agent, your mortgage lender, your friends and relatives, who will color and influence what your decision might have been without them. There will be an unlimited number of pressures that will come on you that you have to deal with. For those of you who are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And we've been talking about purchasing a home in the context of your whole financial situation and building a future which is financially stable, and ultimately building some wealth for yourself. And you concluded that you were at the point where you can actually get a house, but now you're being influenced by a number of forces and pressures around you, which we call the buts. And you have to consider these issues very carefully. For example, the first issue is the issue of buying because of appreciation, rather than for the other issues that we discussed. There are a lot of so-called experts out there who would like to convince you that if you want to build wealth, real wealth, a lot of wealth, you need to start right now with buying a house, because over time that house will increase quite a lot in appreciation, and that's money in your pocket. Well, housing appreciation really has become an American story, and there is just enough truth in it to keep the myth alive. And there certainly are a lot of cheerleaders out there pushing the myth, and there are those who have made money from it. the point that they will always be raising is that the market will always go up and you can make lots of money. The important point is not to get caught up in the frenzy of that possibility and lose your reasoning in choosing your house and mortgage, etc. Because when we look at the reality, it's a lot less exciting for most people than the anecdotal mythical stories that you will hear. The truth is that on average, home values usually rise at roughly the same pace as inflation, which means on the bottom line that putting your money into a home is really like putting your money into a passbook savings account, but not nearly as good as putting it into the stock market. At least that's true historically with the stock market. For example, if you had bought a typical $100,000 home back in 1977, today you would own a home worth about $308,000. That's not bad, but if you had put that same money into the stock market back in 1977, today you would have just over $1 million without having paid, of course, for all of the repairs and maintenance that the house needed. And of course, we have to be cognizant of the fact that the market does go up and down. And as I have spoken about in the past, it is important to do long-term investing in the market, not running after daily changes in stock to come up with this kind of result. And the second point is that, in truth, there have been some phenomenal run-ups in home prices, but also there have been phenomenal crashes. And this is what we have to be careful about if we're going to be primarily motivated by this appreciation factor, which is really a theory for most people, in fact, when going to buy a home. Between 1989 and 1993, for example, the value for a typical home, when adjusted for inflation, actually dropped by 7%. And currently in the market, what you're hearing is the truth that the value of homes almost across the country are dropping in really a frightening amount. And over time, many cities have experienced really, really big real estate crashes. And with the current foreclosures that are going on across the country, the value of homes is going down almost everywhere. And as I've discussed in the past, even people who are not having any problems paying their mortgages, but are in neighborhoods with a couple of homes that are in foreclosure, will find that the value of their house is going down. So you have to be very aware of the fact that you cannot buy a house with the guarantee that prices will rise and markets will stay hot. That's not the primary reason for buying a house. The best financial reason for owning a home is not so you can resell it for a bunch of money. At best, making big money is a very long shot, certainly nothing you should gamble on, particularly when considering that one-third or more of your paycheck every month will go towards paying the mortgage for the next 30 years. So as I said last week, the best financial reasons for home ownership are: one day you will get your house paid off and you can live rent-free for the rest of your life. 2, owning your own home is a great safeguard against inflation. Rents, of course, will keep rising, but a fixed mortgage is just that. It's fixed. And lastly, 3, over the long run, money you would have spent on rent goes towards building something valuable in your life. Home ownership has some ups and downs, but over time it is more like passbook savings, giving a respectable return on your investment, but you really shouldn't consider it as an exciting bet for making lots of money like high rollers. So if you need to wait for a few years while you save for your down payment and pay off your debt, just don't fret about that. You want to start from the strongest, most stable possible place when you jump into buying a home. So that was the first but. Now, the second but, which you will hear from the environment and which seems to make some sense emotionally, is that rent is a waste of money. the logic really seems to be very rock solid there. At the end of the month, you have nothing to show for all that money you spent on rent. But the same applies to all of your bills, your heating bill, your water bill, your food bill, your transportation bills. Always at the end of the month, there are a lot of things you pay for that you don't have anything to show tangibly, nothing except that, in fact, you have lived your life. So think about it this way. When you paid your rent, you received what you needed, a roof over your head. Rent is no different from food, yet most of us are not going to go out and get a cow to deal with the food issues. Another point, too, is that you have to consider the math of buying a home. If rent is a waste of money in your thinking, then presumably the money you put into owning your home is not wasted because it goes towards something valuable. But when you look at the math carefully, how much of the money actually goes to your personal bottom line? Well, the fact is, not much. So, for example, if you buy a house today with no down payment, for the first several years that you quote-unquote own your home, more than 90% of your payments will go to interest, fees, taxes, and insurance. 90%. That money will be just as lost as the money you would have spent on rent. In the early years of home owning, renting can look about the same to your wallet, and frankly, it can be less stressful for many, many people. Of course, over the long run, it's generally better and wiser to own your home than to rent because part of your money goes towards something valuable. Although, as I just said, in the early years, it's only a very small part of your money. But that's really over the long run. In the short run, it really doesn't make any difference whether you rent or own. In other words, then, if you wait a year or two until you are stronger financially, a bigger part of what you pay each month will go towards your bottom line, not the mortgage companies. And that's really worth the wait. So you hold on and you don't get sucked into it unless you are really absolutely ready to move into buying the house. Then comes along another but everyone should own a home. With that thought, let's start with a quick test. What do you do when the toilet overflows? 1, call the landlord. 2, find a plunger. If your answer was 1, call the landlord, home ownership might not be right for you, or at least not right now. Because home ownership can be a lot of work, and if you just don't feel like taking it on, then renting may be the better bet. Also, if you move around a lot, home ownership probably isn't worth a hassle. You can be forced to sell on short notice just when the market is in a low point, and with the total expenses, real estate commissions, closing costs, inspection fees, and the rest of that, which is on the average 9% of the sales price of the house, you can be left in a deep financial hole. And another thing you need to look at is the market where you live. If you live in a market where a home costs quite a lot, renting may be the only wise and prudent decision, at least for now. Some markets get badly overheated, and waiting for them to cool off a bit may make sense. In short, before you sign up for the 30 years of payments, it's okay to take a deep breath and ask whether home ownership is right for you, right here, right now. This may not be the time or the place, and it's really perfectly fine to pull back from buying if you decide you're not quite yet ready, regardless of the pressures from the environment. And we'll continue next week with more of the buts about purchasing a home. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.